officially started. Isn't that exciting? Right, who has read the book of Judges? Okay, that's okay. Totally no problem if you haven't. Who hasn't read the book of Judges? Who hasn't read the book of Judges? Okay, you don't have to look at your shoes. Yeah, bits and pieces, yeah, okay. Which of the bits, before you read the book of Judges, say, recently, which were the bits of the book that were familiar to you, that you'd heard of? Which were the stories, Alistair, which are the stories that you said that you read bits and pieces? Which are the bits of Judges that are familiar to you? Yep, Samson and Delilah. Yep. Yeah, Gideon. Yeah, that's right. And all the bits that we did in Sunday school. Did you do any bits in Sunday school other than Samson and Delilah and the story of Gideon?
Gideon, those are probably the two main ones.
Yeah, okay.
Maybe Deborah.
Yeah, maybe Deborah. Yeah, that's right, because she seems like, you know.
Is that the story that you just can't... Not
yeah, so Rob, do you want to tell us about that? So, what's the story of the fat king?
I can't remember which judge it was, but one of the judges seeks an audience with the king, and I think vaguely recall like him like spearing the king's stomach or something, and the king's officials are outside thinking, oh, he's taking a dump. and he's taking a really long time in there and getting a bit embarrassed, and then they walk in and find that the king's been killed.
Yeah. Yep.
I don't remember the context of that.
No. Well, you've more or less told the story. So there's the story of it's King Ehud. It's Eglon, who's king of Moab, which is one of Israel's enemies. The judge in question who deals with him is Ehud. He's a left-handed man. He's from the south of the country, so he's the southpaw from the south. Southpaw is a name for a left-hander. He goes in and assassinates this king who has been oppressing him. And the bit that's, you know, it's extremely gory. King Eglon is so fat that it is remarked upon that when the sword goes in, like his gut basically swallows the sword, kind of sucks it in, it kind of covers over the hilt, and then the kind of. But the funny bit is that all of his attendants are outside, they have no idea what's going on, thinking, I think the king must be on the toilet. Man, he's taking a really long time. And they wait there, and the quote is, they wait until the point of embarrassment. And then they go in and they find that he's gone, and then Ehud has gone off. So, yeah, that's right. That's one of the judges' stories, well-beloved of, you know, kind of 10 and 11-year-old boys. I remember being on a youth camp when I found one of my leaders reading that story to a room full of 10-year-old boys to get them to sleep, and the boys were just... this is in the Bible? This is fantastic. I had no idea it was so violent and gory. Anything else? What else do we know about the book of Judges? Jephthah. What are we familiar? Okay, Deb, sorry?
Jephthah.
What do we know about Jephthah?
Ended up by a millstone on his head.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Absolutely. Other stories from Judges that we're aware of? That we've heard of? That was in Numbers.
Numbers.
But Barak sounds like he should be a, you know, kind of in there. Yeah, that's right.
Excuse me, does Mike have my pen back
now? Oh, yeah, of course you can have your pen back. Sorry, Gary. There are two types of people in the world. There's pen lenders and there's pen stealers. I'm a pen stealer. So if your pen's gone missing, I've probably got it.
We've just counted 22
in one of our
containers.
Oh, really? Don't feel so bad. Yeah, okay. So, I suppose the long and the short of it is, Judges is a book which we've all heard of it, and most of us are familiar with at least a few characters from it, in particular Samson and Delilah, and Gideon, probably running a fairly close second in Christian circles. But there are lots of others that we haven't heard of, and probably most of us don't necessarily know how the book as a whole hangs together. Necessarily when it falls in Israelite history, necessarily even what a judge is or what the themes of the book are. And that's really what we're going to cover now. So, when When's the book of Judges set? And I'm going to kind of do some scribbling up here so, to help us. But I want to talk as little as possible, and I want you guys to talk as much as possible. So when's the book of Judges set?
Just after Joshua and the Israelites conquered the promised land and had subdued most of, but not all of, the local inhabitants.
Yes.
And Joshua's, I think he dies in the first chapter of Judges.
Yeah, okay. So think about it this way. So it's bookended between... So the first thing that happens is... It's just after Joshua dies.
They're thinking BC 1425.
There you go. 1425, roughly. There is some argument. There is some argument about that because we're not quite sure when Moses was around. Believe it or not, you can actually argue sort of upwards of about a century. There's a bit of sort of a century of when that could happen. But let's go with the date, which I'm presuming the booklet provides, or is that your study Bible that's saying 1425?
Thompson Chain
saying it. Yeah, okay. That's arguable. We don't know when, but let's go with 1425. It doesn't matter. So it's after Joshua. What's happened in the book of Joshua? So to get the context, so what's happened immediately before Judges? Yeah, they've arrived at the Promised Land, absolutely. So Deuteronomy... So the fifth book in the Bible, the end of the Pentateuch, ends with Israel perched on the edge of the Promised Land for a second time. They wussed out the first time they got there. We saw that in Numbers, and that's why they wandered around in the desert for 40 years, so that that faithless generation could die out and a second generation could come up, and then God decides to give them another go at entering into the Promised Land. And that's where we end at the end of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy is just the restatement of the law and all the promises of God to prepare them to enter the land again. Yeah, so that's the end of Deuteronomy. And then you've got Joshua when they actually do invade the land. And that's largely what the book of Joshua is. The first half of the book of Joshua is... very interesting to our eyes and ears. It's full of wars and sieges and conquest. The second half of the book of Joshua is much less interesting to our ears. It's basically a whole bunch of descriptions of land and which tribe got which bits of land and all that kind of stuff. Terribly boring to us. Very interesting to you if you're an Israelite who's mentioned in the book of Joshua, and that's your land titles, you know, kind of list there. And that's where we end. What's the situation in Israel at the time of Joshua's death? The promise is that the Israelites will go in and drive the Canaanites out, and God will give them a set portion of land, and he kind of describes it all, what the land will look like, and he'll give the lot to them once they've driven the Canaanites out. What's the state of play at the end of Joshua's life?
The Israelites aren't finding it quite as easy as they thought.
Mm. Yeah, they're not gaining the land, are they? Yep, okay.
So because they've had major victories, they've defeated all, you know, the five kings of the north and taken major cities, but there's still some cities and I guess probably regions where the Canaanites and etc. are still living around. They haven't completely cleared out the land.
Yes.
Because at the end of Joshua, God says... You will. He was talking future tense. I will give you the land totally, basically.
Yes. Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. So there's what you'd call partially successful conquest. So they've gone in. They've driven out a lot of the Canaanites. There have been some crushing victories on behalf of the Israelites. They've done some really good work there. And they've been able to dig down. They've been able to establish settlements, establish townships. You know, it's looking like the Israelites, you know, they're going to be there. But they haven't driven out all of the Canaanite population. They're going to now need to start working out from those settlements that they've established and go on raiding parties and, you know, kind of do the mop-up job. That's the kind of, that's the military, picture here after Joshua dies. So that's where the book starts. what and the situation that Israel is in. And we're actually going to read a couple of chapters of Joshua, a couple of chapters of Judges, simply to get ourselves familiar with the book, but also because the first couple of chapters of Judges actually summarise the book for us in a really helpful way. So if the book summarises it for us, well, why don't we actually go to the book's own summary? What about at the end? When does Judges finish? Or if you're not quite sure when Judges finishes, what comes straight after Judges? Yeah, the books of Samuel, that's right. Or in our English Bibles, we divide them up into 1 and 2 Samuel. In the Hebrew Bible, there is no division. It's just the book of Samuel. Yep, that's right. And what does the book of Samuel kick off with?
Setting up the new king. Samuel setting up the new king, Saul.
Yeah, that's right. So you've got it's this period here. This is where it starts. And then you've got the end. Is Samuel, Saul, and the kings. That's right. And that we see that in the book of Samuel. Now, Ruth is sandwiched in here, but it doesn't come after the book of Judges. It happens at the same time as the book of Judges. Now, we're not looking at Ruth today, but that's just so you know when you're reading your Bible and you go, hang on, there's Ruth in between Judges and 1 Samuel. What's all that about? If Judges is looking at the big picture of what's going on in Israel during this period, Ruth hones in on a little domestic scene at exactly the same time in a really lovely way. I'm not going to say any more about Ruth. It's a great book. Okay, so that's when we've got there. So it's basically, Judges covers the period between the death of Joshua, at which point they've got a partially successful conquest, but they've then got to go and get rid of the rest of the Canaanites. But just before the kings, it covers a period of about, call it 240 years, roughly. So that's the kind of time period we're looking at here. So when you think about it, actually quite a lot of history in only 21 chapters. Like that's basically the period coming close to the period of, say, white settlement in Australia. Like it's actually dealing with quite a lot of that stuff. And you know that the big theme of what Judges is going to be about will be, are they going to drive out the Canaanites? That's the big question that we've got to be looking at when we're reading the book of Judges. This is what God wants them to do. The question is, will Israel do it? So let's actually read the first couple of chapters of Judges, because that will help set the scene. Now, first of all, are there any questions about the time frame, the setting, the context, any of that kind of stuff? You've got to go. Okay, good-o. That's fine. See, enjoy music. Okay.
One question.
Yeah.
Why do you think God appointed Moses and then Joshua? Why do you think he didn't appoint another leader to sort of like over the 12 tribes as opposed to just these judges that sort of popped up from time to time?
Why wasn't there a
continual like leader of the whole Israelite of all the 12 tribes?
Yes. Can I remember that question, and I'm going to hang it up on a peg here, and we'll come back to it.
Yep.
Because I think as we look on, we'll actually answer that question. But it's an excellent question, absolutely. Because a big question that's raised in the book of Judges is leadership. Mm-hmm. Because in the period of Judges, you have a quite unique form of leadership going on, that of the judgeship. And we'll come to define what that is and why it is. Gary.
I was going to say somewhere at the end they say something about they think everything's going right because we do not have a king to lead us. And so that, maybe that's sort of partially answering.
Well, then we're going to get to that right in the very last bit because you've picked up on an interesting refrain that comes up there. Okay, we're going to read chapter 1, verse 1, to chapter 3, verse 6. And it won't take us that long. So, Sandra, sorry, you have the misfortune of being on my left. Do you want to lead off? Thank you.
Now, after the death of Joshua, it came to pass that the children of Israel asked the Lord, saying, "Who shall go up for us against the Canaanites, first to fight against them?" And the Lord said, "Judah shall go up. Behold, I have delivered the land into his hand." And Judah said to Simeon his brother, "Come up with me into my lot that we may fight against the Canaanites, and I will go up with you into your lot." So Simeon went with him. And Judah went up, and the Lord delivered the Canaanites and the Perizzites into their hand, and they slew them in Bezek, 10,000 men. And they found Adoni-Bezek in Bezek, and they fought against him, and they slew the Canaanites and the Perizzites. But Adoni-Bezek fled, and they pursued after him and caught him and cut off his thumbs and his great toes. And Adoni-Bezek said, 70 kings, having their thumbs and their great toes cut off, gathered their meat under my table, as I have done. So God has acquitted me. And they brought him to Jerusalem, and there he died.
How far do you want to read?
Just read until you get tired and then just say pass. And if you don't want to read out loud, by the way, it's okay, just say pass. That's perfectly all right. Well, you were the first person.
The men of Judah attacked Jerusalem also and took it. They put the city to the sword and set it on fire. After that, Judah went down to fight against the Canaanites, living in the hill country, the Negev and the western foothills. They advanced against the Canaanites living in Hebron, formerly called Kiriath Arba, and defeated Sheshai, Ahiman, and Talmai. From there they advanced against the people living in Debir, formerly called Kiriath Sefer. And Caleb said, "I will give my daughter Aksa in marriage to the man who attacks and captures Kiriath Sefer."
Othniel,
son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, took it. So Caleb gave his daughter Aksa to him in marriage. One day when she came to Othniel, she urged him to ask her father for a field. When she got off her donkey, Caleb asked her, "What can I do for you?" She replied, "Do me a special favour. Since you have given me land in the Negev, give me also springs of water." So Caleb gave her upper and lower springs. I'll pass now.
The descendants of Moses, father-in-law, the Canaanites, went up from the city of Paran with the people of Judah, who lived among the inheritance of the desert of Judah in the Negev near Arad. Then the men of Judah went with the Simeonites, their fellow Israelites, and attacked the Canaanites living in Zephath, and they totally deserted the city. Therefore, it was called Hamah. Judah also took together Ascanon and Carim, each city with its territory. The Lord was with the men of Judah. They took possession of the hill country, but there were unable to drive the people from the plains because they had chariots fitted with iron. As Moses had promised, Hebron was given to Caleb, who drove from the three sons of Anak. The Benjamins, however, did not drive out the Jebusites, who were living in Jerusalem. To this day, the Jebusites living there with the Benjamins.
Now the tribes of Joseph attacked Bethel, and the Lord was with them. When they sent men to spy out Bethel, formerly called Luz, the spies saw a man coming out of the city, and they said to him, "Show us how to get into the city, and we will see that you are treated well." So he showed them, and they put the city to the sword, but spared the man and his whole family. He then went to the land of the Hittites, where he built a city and called it Luz, which is its name to this day. But Manasseh did not drive out the people of Beth-shan, or Tanach, or Dor, or Iblon, or Megiddo, and the surrounding settlements, for the Canaanites were determined to live in that land. When Israel became strong, they pressed the Canaanites into forced labor, but never drove them out completely. Nor did Ephraim drive out the Canaanites living in Gezer, but the Canaanites continued to live there among them. Neither did Zebulun drive out the Canaanites living in Kitron or in Nahal? So these Canaanites lived among them, but Zebulun did subject them to forced labor. Nor did Asher drive out those living in Akko or Sidon or Ahab, Ahlab or Ak.
It's an unfair thing to get you to read, isn't it? But I'm going to keep doing it anyway.
The Asherites lived among the Canaanites, inhabitants of the land, because they did not drive them out. Neither did Naphtali drive out those living in Beth-Shemes or Beth-Anath. But the Naphtalites too lived among the Canaanite inhabitants of the land. And those living in Beth-Shemesh and Beth-Anath became forced laborers for them. The Amorites confined the Danites to the hill country, but allowing them to come down into the plain. And the Amorites were determined also to hold out in Mount Heres. Ajalon and Shalbim. But when the power of the tribes of Joseph increased, they too were pressed into forced labor. The boundary of the Amorites was from Scorpion Pass to Salah and beyond.
Well done, people. That's tough, particularly on a Sunday afternoon. It's like racing the hurdles, isn't it? And each name is a hurdle that you've got to get over. Okay, so what happens in that chapter in really broad terms? And there are no trick questions here. They didn't get rid of the Canaanites, but I suppose a step before then is the chapter opens with them dealing with exactly this problem. They've only got a partially successful conquest. And so they do the very natural thing and say, right, who's going to come and drive out the Canaanites? And so you see the chapter where you see first, it's harder for us to tell on a first reading, but it first deals with the south and then it deals with the northern tribes. We're actually changing scenes here halfway through, but it shows you the state of the campaign and summarises the state of the campaign to continue that conquest across there to drive out the Canaanites, because, of course, that's what Israel's been told to do. Now, Joan, you gave your assessment of how they went on that. How have they gone on their mission to drive out the Canaanites? Yeah.
I think they got to the mountains, didn't they, and then couldn't go any further with their chariots.
Yes.
And so they just said, well, we'll just live with you instead.
Yeah.
They just do what amongst
them. Every tribe didn't remove the Canaanites, including the Judah.
Yep. Yeah, that's right. That's right. So in other words, in short, they don't drive out the Canaanites. And there are various reasons for that. At some points they say, oh, look, the Canaanites, they've got better tech than us. You know, they've got iron chariots and we haven't got iron yet. We haven't quite moved into the Iron Age yet, which Israel hadn't. But at the same time, God has promised them, you've got to drive out the Canaanites and I'm going to help you do it. Doesn't matter that you've only got bronze. I'm going to help you do it. And yet they don't. What do they do instead? What do they do instead when they can't beat the Canaanites? When they can't actually kill or expel the Canaanites, what do they do instead?
Well, they follow what Joshua did earlier on in the book. They made them carriers of water and choppers of wood, didn't they?
Yeah, that's right.
But if you look at verse 2 there, Judah shall go up, I have given the land into their hands. It didn't say give the people into your hands.
Yeah, although you do see, certainly from the book of Deuteronomy, the idea is that they are to have this land for themselves. And can you remember, and again, this is a course on Judges, it's not a course on Deuteronomy, but can you remember what the great danger would be for Israel if they let Canaanites live next door to them and just go, okay, look, let's just be neighbours? What was going to be the great danger of that? There's going to be intermarriage.
And they're going to follow after their gods.
Now, one would often lead to the other. So Barry meets Debbie and Debbie worships Ashtaroth. And so Barry goes, oh, okay, so I might worship Ashtaroth as well.
And so their kids do. And
all that kind of stuff. Which, of course, if that starts happening, that is a disaster. Because the whole point of Israel entering the land is they are meant to be a showcase of what a group of people looks like when they're under the control of the true God, Yahweh. They're meant to be the model nation so that every other country can look in and go, oh, wow, life under their God is really different to life under everyone else's gods. I wonder if they're onto something there. Of course, when you don't do that and you start worshipping other gods, well, Israel doesn't look distinct anymore. It begins to look like any other nation. And in fact, by the time we get to the end of Judges, the tragedy is that Israel is just completely indistinguishable from any other. They are just another Canaanite tribe, basically.
Well, more than that, they're not God's people anymore, are they?
Well, and that's, I suppose that's the same way of, it's a different way of saying the same thing. There's just nothing distinctive about them anymore.
I mean, that's the whole point why God wanted to decimate the whole towns and just get rid of the population, wasn't it? So that they weren't basically corrupted by the people.
That's right.
And the gods.
Yeah, that's right. And Judges actually goes on, and we'll actually move on to this. So, Rob, if I can ask you to take it up from here. In chapter 2... it actually gives a little explanation as to why they haven't been successful and what God is going to do as a result. So do you just want to read out chapter 2, verses 1 to 5 for us?
Sure.
Thank you.
The angel of the Lord went up from Gilgal to Bochim and said, I brought you out of Egypt and led you into the land that I swore to give to your forefathers. I said, I would never break my covenant with you, and I will not make a covenant with the people of this land. But you shall break down their altars. Yet you have disobeyed me. Why have you done this? Now therefore I tell you that I will not drive them out before you. They will be thorns in your sides, and their gods will be a snare to you. When the angel of the Lord had spoken these things to all the Israelites, the people wept out loud, and they called that place Bochim. There they offered sacrifices to the Lord.
So what's the angel there say to them? Why is that bit there? It's fine to take another look at it.
They disobeyed him, basically. Mm-hmm. Says you have disobeyed me.
Yeah.
But why is your people so quickly worship other gods?
You said, why do they so quickly worship other gods?
Yeah, forgot the true God.
Yeah. And that's one of the questions that I think we're meant to ask. Where, you know, it's like when there are numbers out in the desert. They've just been rescued after 430 years of captivity in Egypt. And within a month, they're already complaining about the food. You know, it doesn't take very long for human beings to reject God.
It's hard to imagine that, though, isn't it? I mean, like, you know, when they just got out of Egypt, God's just done all that stuff, and then they start making golden calves and going off the tracks when Moses is not there, and you think, they've just seen God do amazing stuff.
Yeah. Which...
you could make a parallel with us today.
Yep.
In the Bible dictionary, I was looking at the article on the Canaanites.
Yes.
And it said there that they had so many gods. They had a god for everything. God for today, and God for tomorrow, God for the rain, God for the sun, and whatever.
Mm.
And some of those gods were made so attractive to the people. If they wanted to go grow a good crop, for instance, they prayed to a particular god. And if they wanted rain at the right time, they prayed to another god. And it said in the article there that the appeal to the Israelites would have been fantastically heavy.
Yes.
Because they're coming into a land they didn't really understand and know. And people were successful, and all these gods were the reason for their success. So
but they had their history, didn't they?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they forgot it so quickly.
Yeah, they did.
That's it. They've got their history. And it keeps being, like in Deuteronomy, it was totally, basically, I mean, I have read those recently, so...
Yes.
And it was just basically going through the whole history again and reminding them what everything that God's done for them.
Yeah.
And also reminding them if they don't, you know, if they go off the track, what are the consequences as well.
Yeah.
And they still go off, but I guess we're all, it's a human condition.
We can't.
And the interesting thing is God's primary complaint with the Israelites here in chapter 2, verse 2... is their failure to break down the Canaanites' altars. And so, again, it's the threat of idolatry. That's the big issue there. Yeah, that's right. Now, we're going to read chapter 2, verses 6 to 3, verse 6, and that will actually summarise the whole rest of the book for us, which doesn't mean you need not continue to read the rest of Judges, but it is a very handy summary. So, Michael, do you want to start off for us there? And again, if you want to pass, do feel free to pass. That's fine.
After Joshua had dismissed the Israelites, they went to take possession of the land, each to their own inheritance. The people served the Lord throughout the lifetime of Judah and of the elders who outlived him and who had seen all the great things the Lord had done for Israel. Joshua, son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110, and they buried him in the land of his inheritance at Timnah-Heres in the hill country of Ephraim, north of Mount Gash. After that whole generation had been gathered to their ancestors, another generation grew up who knew neither the Lord nor what he had done for them. Then the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord and served the Baals. They forsook the Lord, the God of their ancestors, who had brought them out of Egypt. They followed and worshipped various gods of the people around them. They aroused the Lord's anger, because they forsook him and served Baal and the Asherahs. In his anger against Israel, the Lord gave them into the hands of the raiders, who plundered them. He sold them into the hands of their enemies all around, whom they were no longer able to resist. Whenever Israel went out to fight, the hand of the Lord was against them to defeat them, just as he had sworn to them. They were in great distress.
And the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hands of these raiders. Yet they would not listen to their judges, but prostituted themselves to other gods and worshipped them. Unlike their fathers, they quickly turned from the way in which their fathers had walked, the way of obedience to the Lord's commands. Whenever the Lord raised up a judge for them, he was with the judge and saved them out of the hands of their enemies. As long as the judge lived, the Lord had compassion on them as they groaned under those who oppressed them and afflicted them. But when the judge died, the people returned to the ways even more corrupt than those of their fathers, followed other gods and serving and worshipping them. They refused to give up all evil practices and stubborn ways. Therefore, the Lord was very angry with Israel and said, because this nation has violated the covenant that I laid down for the forefathers and has not listened to me, I will no longer drive out before them any of the nations Joshua left when he died. I will use them to test Israel and see whether they will keep the way of the Lord and walk in it as their forefathers did. The Lord had allowed those nations to remain. He did not drive them out at once by giving them into the hands of Joshua.
These are the nations the Lord left to test all those Israelites who had not experienced any of the wars in Canaan. He did this only to teach warfare to the descendants of the Israelites who had not previous battle experience. The five rulers of the Philistines, all the Canaanites, the Sidonians, Hivites living in the Lebanon mountains from Mount Baal Hermon to Lebo Hamath. They were left to test the Israelites to see whether they would obey the Lord's command, which he had given their ancestors through Moses. The Israelites lived among the Canaanites, Hittites, Ammonites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. They took their daughters in marriage and gave their own daughters to their sons and served.
Okay. And that really, 2 verse 6 to 3 verse 6, that's the book in a nutshell, really. And so the author has deliberately summarised all of the history, all of that 240 years right there. So you can see that he goes back to a flashback. If you remember, we started in 1 verse 1 after the death of Joshua. Here in 2 verse 6, we actually go slightly before then. You know, so it's after Joshua had dismissed the Israelites. So we're back at the beginning again. And then it tells us about a pattern that happens. And this is a pattern that will really dictate all of the history of what goes on in Israel for the next 240 years. And it's like a cycle, really. And so this is basically the cycle, and you can see it there described in those opening chapters. Oh, gosh, it's not rubbing off terribly well. Oh, no, whiteboard. Very good. So you've got the cycle. So you've got Israel, sin. And God gets fed up. And then he punishes them. And then the particular way he punishes them here in the book of Judges is he oppresses them with a foreign nation. And, you know, some awful Canaanite tribe comes and thumps them. And no matter how hard the Israelites fight against them or ever try and go out, you know, it says, doesn't matter, they always go out, they always lose. You know, all of a sudden Israel becomes the Carlton of the Canaanite world. Doesn't matter how many times they play, they lose. I get to say that, I'm a Carlton supporter. Very nominal. Oppression. But then the Israelites, they cry out. They cry out for mercy. And you'll see that. And we'll just read one more section before we're done today at 4, where we see this actually play out in the life of a judge. They cry out for mercy. And then God listens. And he appoints a judge. And we'll come back to what a judge is in a minute, in a second rather. And then the judge actually rescues Israel from their oppressors, and there is peace for the lifetime of the judge. The judge then dies. Judge dies. Israel sins, and then the whole thing starts all over again. And that's really what the book of Judges describes, this cycle of sin, oppression, repentance of a sort. God raises up a judge who rescues them. There's peace during this period here. The judge dies. Israel forgets. They sin and the whole thing starts all over again. And that's really the pattern. And when it comes to the way that Judges is structured, we see this pattern happen. So we've got an introduction. We've actually just read the first whole section of Judges. So you've got the intro, which is 1:1 to 3:6. And then you've got the period of the judges, which is 3:7 until the end of chapter 16. And then you've got 17 to 21, which we'll deal with in a minute. But this cycle that we've had summarised for us in 2:6 to 3:6 is really just that whole middle section just fleshes that out in the lives of the judges and what goes on there. Are there any questions about that cycle?
I can't quite read the last one before sin.
Oh, I'm sorry. Judge dies. My handwriting is terrible.
Okay.
Does that make sense? Yeah. Rob?
In the book of the Judges, did the Israelites follow like everything that was prescribed in Deuteronomy in terms of keeping all the...
food laws and stuff?
Food laws and the, like remembering the Passover and all like... festivals and all those sorts of things?
Or? As far as we know, absolutely not. It doesn't really say, but the impression is that no, they just forget all of that. I think we assume that because they're the Israelites, they'll actually still remember and keep those laws. To the best of our knowledge, they just don't. They actually become paganized very, very quickly. It's what actually makes Ruth such an interesting counterpoint, because there you see... There's a little mini version of Israel on at least one farm in Israel, because you do actually see one Israelite, Boaz, actually keeping those laws. He clearly remembers the laws from Deuteronomy and he's keeping them. But the impression here in Judges is no, all of that has been forgotten or certainly ignored.
So does that mean that most of the Levites are not actually operating as priests, they've gone back into...
Well, mate, it's interesting you should mention Levites, Rob, because we're going to get to Levites in 17 to 21. And I tell you what, these are not Levites you would ever want to meet. They have completely chucked it in. If you think this is bad, 17 to 21 is really... they're probably some of the darkest chapters in the Bible, really. And we'll get there briefly. So this is the cycle here. Now, what's a judge? When you think of a judge, when you hear the word judge, what do you think? wise. Yeah, okay. What does a judge do?
You think of a courtroom judge.
You think of a courtroom judge. You think of a judicial officer. That's right. Someone who settles arguments, hands down, all those kinds of things, all that kind of stuff. That's not what is meant by the word judges here. A judge is a military leader. So it's got nothing really to do with sitting in a courtroom and settling disputes and banging a gavel and wearing a wig or any of those kinds of things. They're a military leader, and they are a one-off military leader. So in that sense, they are a bit like Joshua and Moses, to take your question back off its peg, Rob, who were also one-offs. Because, of course, Joshua, Joshua wasn't Moses' son. There wasn't like a... God hadn't set up a dynasty. He hadn't worked out, okay, how are we going to lead Israel? Well, okay, well, I'll just get the kid of the last leader. He can be the next leader. You have to start all over again. And that's what he did with Joshua after Moses, and that's what he's done with the judges after Joshua. So you get these series of one-off leaders, and away they go.
But there's no selection of a guy on quality or ethics or anything like that?
Yes, so does God choose particularly good people in order to be judges? Well, Michael, I'm glad you asked. Why don't we actually read one last section? Because we're going to read the story of Othniel, which is chapter 3, verses 7 to 11. Actually, why don't I read that? I'm very happy to read that. So this is the first judge we actually come across in this cycle. And it's good because it actually illustrates the cycle as it happened. So the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. They forgot the Lord their God and served the Baals and the Asherahs. Well, that's sin, isn't it? So that's the first part of the cycle there. The anger of the Lord burnt against Israel so that he sold them into the hands of Cushan-Rishathaim, king of Aram-Naharaim, to whom the Israelites were subject for 8 years. Well, there's oppression. But when they cried out to the Lord, that's crying out, he raised up for them a deliverer, Othniel, son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, who saved them. The Spirit of the Lord came on him so that he would become Israel's judge, or he became Israel's judge and went to war. The Lord gave Cushan-Rishathaim, king of Aram, into the hands of Othniel, who overpowered him. So the land had peace for 40 years, that's here, until Othniel, son of Kenaz, died. It's just perfect, isn't it? It's the perfect model. But then again, verse 12, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord, and because they did this evil, the Lord gave Eglon, king of Moab, power over Israel. And you're back to oppression. And you see that happening. And that's the cycle as it gets played out. Now, it is a cycle. It's fair to say, though, is everyone clear with that idea? That's all cool. So it is a cycle, but it's actually a little bit more than a cycle. It's more accurate to actually also describe it as a spiral. Because a cycle just makes you go, okay, well, this is just going to go on from chapter 3 to 16, but it won't particularly get any worse. The thing is, it does actually get worse. So it's not just a cycle. It's more like that. And you could broadly clump them together into four main areas. So you've got chapter 3, verse 6, to... where would I take it up to? Probably chapter 5. Is it chapter 5? I can't remember. You've got the judges. They're pretty good. These are good guys. So this is people like, you got Othniel, who was just raised up. Then you've got Ehud, which is the guy who kills Eglon. You've got Shamgar. Shamgar gets one line in the Bible. We know nothing about him. Deborah, who leads there, and then you've got the Song of Deborah there in chapter 5, and then you've got Gideon, who is in 6 to 9, they're all okay, or rather certainly these guys are all pretty okay. They're good, although one of the things you even, because this goes to your question, Michael, about did God select them for particular things about them, it doesn't seem that he's necessarily picked them for their military skills or the kinds of things that you'd normally select. In fact, the text seems to go out of its way to show that these guys are kind of unusual. So Othniel, we know nothing about Othniel. He is just a model judge. But Ehud, it's pointed out that he's left-handed. Now, of course, there's nothing wrong with being left-handed, but it's noteworthy. It's the kind of thing where you go, oh, that's unusual. Shamgar, his name, particularly given that he's the son of Anath, probably isn't even an Israelite. Well, that's unusual. Deborah is a woman. Again, there's nothing unusual with being a woman, but it is unusual being a woman who's a leader of Israel. That's unusual. And so you actually see they're pretty good, but even now they're kind of odd. Then you get to Gideon in 6 to 9, and he's good. But Gideon is also a coward.
He's a nobody.
He is something of a coward. He needs a lot of talking into doing his job. And towards the end of his life, he actually ends up becoming a bit murderous. And interestingly, begins to sort of take on pretensions to kingship. So it's interesting, Gideon has a son called Abimelech. Well, Abimelech means my father is the king. If I call my son my father is the king, what am I saying about me? That I'm the king. Which, of course, he's not. Because what's the distinction between being a judge and a king? What's the big difference when it comes to... Well, actually, I'll just ask you, what's the difference between being a judge and a king?
Well, they have a dynasty, as you said before. They have follow one, their children will become the next king, queen.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So when you're a king or a queen, you know who the next leader of your nation is going to be. It's going to be your son or daughter. When you're a judge, you have no idea. You're a one-off appointment. You have no right to a dynasty. That's right, certainly for the nation, that's right. And so that's what happens, which is why at the end of the Gideon narrative, you have chapter 9 with Abimelech, his son, who actually crowns himself king. It's Israel's very first attempt at kingship. People often think that Saul is Israel's first attempt at kingship. It's not. Abimelech is, but he's self-appointed, and he's a disaster. Thankfully, Abimelech dies like everyone else. They're okay. Then you get... chapters 10 to 12, when the judges are just bad. So you've got Tola, Jair, and in particular Jephthah. Jephthah is a gangster. He is a thug from the north. There's absolutely nothing on his CV that would attract you to making him a leader of anyone, of a chicken coop, let alone a country. And yet God picks him. And then you've got 13 to 16... which is Samson. And if you thought Jephthah was bad, Samson is just flat out weird. It's interesting because in all the kids' stories, Samson is often portrayed as a very attractive character, very attractive to boys in particular because, you know, he's a muscle man, he's really strong, and he finishes well in as much as he pulls down the Canaanite temple upon all of the leaders and all of that kind of stuff. But when you actually look at his life, he's awful. He's a womanizer. He's incredibly violent. He's vain.
He doesn't follow any of his
No. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. And so you do actually see this spiral. They start okay, but then they actually end up so bad that by the time you get to Samson, Samson is barely recognizable as a judge of Israel at all. It's just a disaster. And so you see this downward spiral there.
I also looked from it, saw that for the pretty good and the good, the period of peace was 40 years, except for you, which was 80 years.
Yeah.
But then from the bad, it spiraled down to 23 years, and small and small numbers.
Yeah, that's right. So that's that central section there, where you see all those stories. And so already you can actually begin to see how the Book of Judges is not just actually a selection of disconnected stories. There's a progression going on here. Sorry, Michael.
The Book of Judges deals with a tribe here and a tribe there.
Yes.
And it isn't a national thing. It doesn't become national until it gets down the line. So where you've got perhaps one or two tribes get together to beat off a particular
set of ites. Yeah.
What's the rest of the nation doing?
Well, the book focuses on different elements. Scholars have asked the question about whether judges were actually ever, you know, was Jephthah ever the judge of all of Israel, or was he actually just the judge of his little patch and then the rest was left on its own? It is true that when we read about these judges, often they focus on their particular little patch. Taking broader things into consideration, it does actually seem that they are actually leading all of Israel. So in other words, your judge might be from down the south, but the north will still say, oh, well, he's my judge or she's my judge. So there is still that sense of being a national leader, but obviously with a particular focus there. And again, we don't have a capital city yet. We don't have Jerusalem. We see that they've captured Jerusalem for the first time, but it's hardly the capital of Israel. In fact, Jerusalem won't properly become the capital until David. Yeah, that's right. And so that will happen. Yeah, absolutely. So Jerusalem already existed. It was owned there by the Jebusites.
Abraham was there, but they
call
it Salem then.
Yeah, that's right. And so they...
Yeah,
that's right. So in typical ancient history fashion, why make a new capital? You can just nick someone else's. So that's what they did. Then you've got at the end, you've got this epilogue right at the end of the book where... it deals with, if this is your intro, and then 3:6 to the end of chapter 16 is dealing with the political climate. It's looking at the big picture. It's looking at what's happening with the leaders of Israel. 17 to 21 is really looking at what's happening on the ground. What's life like for everyday citizens? So this doesn't come chronologically after everywhere. So this is flashing back again, but focusing in on just the average kind of Joe, yeah? And it's not painting a pretty picture. Here, you've got religious chaos. And here, you've got moral chaos. I won't go into huge amounts of detail about the stories that they talk about. Here, you have a guy who basically just has a do-it-yourself shrine. And so you'll see there in... chapter 17, what's his name? Yeah, that's Micah, a guy called Micah. Now, a man named Micah from the hill country in Ephraim said to his mother, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then he basically, he makes an image and he sets up his own little shrine, and then that causes a fair bit of, you know, kind of another tribe, the tribe of Dan, comes and thumps him for setting up his own religious shrine and altar. In other words, we're a million miles away from Deuteronomy about the kind of worship that is going on here. And then you've got complete moral chaos in 19 to 21, which is the extremely disturbing story of Rob, you asked earlier about Levites. Well, the Levite's at the centre of this. Basically, the Levite has a concubine / prostitute whom he has murdered, dismembered, and then the parts of the body sent to the different corners of the country. And in the end, the chaos, which of course that's only just part of the story, leads to Israel's first civil war. It is something straight out of a Martin Scorsese gangster film, but kind of more violent. So it's very, very dark towards the end. And that's what brings us to the end of the book. But interestingly, at the end of the book, there is that refrain that you mentioned, Gary, before. So why don't, does someone read out chapter 17, verse 6? And do you want to read 18, verse 1 again? No, that's fine. And then 19, just read the first bit again of 19, verse 1. Yep, and then chapter 21, verse 25. That's right. So there's what's called a refrain, which is suddenly introduced here. And you can see it actually bookends this last section. 17 verse 6, and it's also the very last verse in the whole book, 25. And it says, doesn't it, the first and the fourth say, in those days there was no king in Israel, everyone did as he saw fit, and then 2 and 3, just say like a shorter version of that, there was no king in Israel. And it marks that off as a section. Now, why do you think the author suddenly starts saying this? Because this, why do you think the author suddenly introduces that?
Because he's setting us up for Samuel anointing.
Yep.
Samuel is one of the guest writers.
Well, we don't know. We don't know exactly who wrote Judges. It was clearly written, or at least part of it was clearly written after there were kings in Israel, because it's clearly written from the perspective where there are kings in Israel, because otherwise it wouldn't make sense to say there was no king in Israel. So it's clearly written after the period of the kings have come. What does it seem to be explaining? When it says there was no king in Israel, everyone did as they saw fit in their own eyes, how has everyone doing fit as they see in their own eyes been going for the last 240 years? Yeah, it's been getting worse. It's bad. It's not been good to not have a king, has it? Everyone's just been doing what they want. There's been no steady leadership. It works fine while your judge is alive, but then they die and then it all goes bad again and then God needs to raise up another judge, except the pool of available suitable judges seems to be getting thinner and thinner and thinner till by the end of this period, God has to pick Samson of all people. Like, that's the person he's got to choose from. He picks Samson as the leader. There's a leadership crisis here. And it seems to be, so in one sense, it is leading us, it's helping prepare us for the books of Samuel, which will obviously explain the actual rise of the kingship in Israel. But it's also, at least in part, seeming to blame the lack of a king in Israel for some of the things that are going on. In other words, if there was a more stable leadership, then things would have gone better. Now, what do we think about that? Rob. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so, and it doesn't end well for them. The northern tribe gets wiped out by the Assyrians, and the southern tribe gets taken into exile by the Babylonians, and the kings just get
They get worse.
You've got David and Solomon's not too bad, but towards the end of his life, he loses a plot. But then it's just bad king after bad king.
We've made
Josiah and a couple of other.
Yeah, that's right. So it's interesting, isn't it? So you've got there at the end of Judges. Judges seems to be saying at least part of the reason for their complete chaos is they need consistent leadership, the kind of consistent leadership that a kingship can bring, other than just these one-off judges. And then hopefully things will be right then. And then you get the kings. And some good things happen. Certainly far more of the Canaanites get driven out under the kings than they do under the judges. I mean, even Saul is quite good at that. And then you've got David and then you've got Solomon, with the high point of Solomon's kingship happening in 1 Kings 10, where it seems like all of the blessings that God's promised to Abraham have actually finally come true, till you get to 1 Kings 11, when Solomon completely loses his mind. And then it all goes bad, and then you've actually got disastrous kings. So what are we to make of this? On the one hand, Judges seems to be saying, if only Israel had kings, we'd all be okay. But on the other hand, when you see how the kings of Israel actually do, kingship doesn't seem to be the answer. What do we think about that? They've forgotten God. Yeah, okay. What do we think about kingship in particular? Because this is where I want us to conclude. Well, I want us to, you know, we've got 15 minutes left. I want us to come into the New Testament and think through, draw some of these threads together, and then think actually about how this actually applies to us as well.
Well, you need a king who's a good king, a king who's going to be a role model for the country. If you've got a bad king, you're going to have problems. So I suppose a good king could be a type of Christ who is our king. And Lord.
Yep.
So that's the king we need.
Yes.
Not a man who's going to be a corrupt king, but
a king that walks with the Lord.
The best thing, next best thing is a king who walks with the Lord. He's going to be a sinner, but if he walks with the Lord, like David, who was, a man after God's own heart, sort of thing.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Yep.
It's the attributes of the leader, isn't it? In Judges, they picked a guy or a person who could lead the soldiers to go out and fight, but not necessarily a person who had any spiritual background.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not until you get to David, really, or Samuel and David, where you start having a spiritual leader who can then focus people not only on the spirit but also on the people. And on the nation.
Yeah, and that's actually a sub-theme that comes up in Judges. Blink and you'll miss it, but we did actually read about the giving of the Spirit to the judges. And that kind of wends its way a little bit through Judges, where you'll see that the Spirit gets given to the judge in order to help that judge do his, or in the case of Deborah's case, her job to do it. But the Spirit is temporary. And that problem actually goes on into the kingship. That's the big thing about Saul and David. So Saul has God's Spirit. In other words, God says, right, I'm going to give you the spiritual toolkit to do the job I've given you to do, to rule God's people as the king. But if you muck up, I'm taking the Spirit from you. And of course, Saul does muck up. And the Spirit does go from Saul, and the Spirit comes on to David, actually before David is made king. And yet even then, you've still got David who can still say in the Psalms, take not your spirit from me. David recognises that there's a chance that the Spirit could still be taken from him. In other words, there won't be the permanent presence of the Spirit in the life of Israel's king, which of course is what makes it so significant that when Jesus is baptised, who comes on the Lord Jesus? Well, it's the Spirit. And that's what marks Jesus out as God's King, because that's what the Spirit does. The Spirit is God's enabling power for God's King to do God's King's job. But the thing with Jesus is that the Spirit never leaves Jesus. He's always with Jesus, which is what marks him out as the King who will always be able to lead God's people. So what Israel needs, Judges is kind of, it's a little bit there, isn't it? It says, yeah, we do need a king. We need a king. The books of Samuel and Kings show us, yeah, you need a bit more than that. You don't just need a king, you need the king. You need a king who will always have God's Spirit rest on you. And you also need a king who won't die. Because that's obviously a big part of the problem with the judges, isn't it? Everything's going swimmingly until nature takes its course and Jephthah snuffs it. Or Samson dies, and then after that, well, he hasn't got anything anymore. And of course, that happens with even the best kings of David and Solomon. Even they still die, which of course brings the resurrection into great light, isn't it? Because you actually have in Jesus the king whose spirit always rests on him and who never dies. In other words, he's always actually still there to lead God's people, which is obviously putting us in a far greater position than the people living in the period of the judges. It's a helpful way of actually thinking through as we come forward into the New Testament. Now, I want to say one more thing about that before we actually then think about how that might apply to us and then wrap up with any questions. I mean, we've already started thinking about how this fits into the big picture of God's theology, the Bible's overall storyline. When you think about it, really the Bible's story is one of unity and then disunity and then coming back to unity again. So you've got Genesis 1, unity. God's people living in God's place under God's rule. It's all working. That all goes horribly wrong until you get to Genesis 11. You've got the Tower of Babel, you've got the nations everywhere, you've got people dying everywhere. The whole world is now completely disunited. I'm not even sure if that's a word. Divided against God. The rest of the Bible from Genesis 12 on which is really the start of God's rescue mission in that sense, in his promises to Abraham, is all about getting the nation or getting the world back to a point of unity again, united under one king and one people in one place. That's really the storyline of the Bible. Where Judges comes in is, you know, sort of here. It's an early step in the reunification process. How is God going back at reunifying his world? Well, he's certainly not here at Revelation 22, which is, well, a new heavens and a new earth with everyone living under one King Jesus who never loses God's spirit. That's the complete unification that we need after. We're not quite at the period of the church, which is where you see, well, we've got one King, Jesus, and God's people, the church, is spread all over the world. It's not localized in one particular area, but it's still not the whole cosmos under God's control, united under him, is it? So what you've got here is you've got part of the world, i.e. Israel, partially under God's control, in as much as there are judges, they're there for a time, but then they die and kind of, you know, it all goes bad again. Until you get the kings, where you see a little bit more unity. Well, at least you've got them under, one dynasty now, like they're united under a kingship. Do you see how that kind of helps understand where Judges kind of fits in, you know, kind of God's kind of storyline? That's where it fits. Sorry, I should actually write that down. Okay, questions about that? Comments? We've got 10 minutes to go. I think we've covered all the main material.
Too efficient.
Well, no, I don't know about that. Or I just talk too much.
Could I ask a question that doesn't really relate specifically to that? But it's probably in my ignorance, but God's chosen people, were the Israelites that had to be brought back out of Egypt, were they entirely descendants of Jacob? It was just one family. They were Canaanites.
Well, if you remember, what happened is they were imports to Canaan. So we're now going back a step for everyone else. So we're back here in Genesis, where you've got the promises. Promises are made to Abraham. God says, I'm going to make a great nation out of you. Abraham has Isaac. Isaac has Jacob. And then Jacob has his 12 sons, and then they're the 12 tribes of Israel. And it's those guys who, because of a famine, are actually, basically, they go to Egypt because that's where there's actually food there. And they stay there. And so in that sense, yes, they are. And that's the beginning. Those 70 people, those 12 guys and their families, are the beginning. They're the seed of the nation of Israel. And they will stay and continue to grow in Egypt for about 430 years. Hello. Hey, Nicola, how are you going? Good. We're just in the middle of something. Can you come back can you come back in a second? Is that okay?
I just priced it to the wall first.
Have you? Well, can I find out from you after? Can I just come out afterwards and come and talk to you about it?
I'll tell them all first.
Okay, what's the surprise?
On Wednesday, I'm giving up smoking.
Well done. Well done. High five. Good on you. That's a lovely thing to do. Good on you.
Have not been open this Wednesday.
Good. Well done. Okay. Hey, let's talk about it afterwards. I'll see you at church, yeah? Great.
Have that.
That's very good. That's very good. Good on you.
Will I get support from everyone?
Of course you will. Absolutely. That's great. Okay.
It's Wednesday. It's happening.
Very good. Okay. Thanks, Nicola. Okay. I'll see you out there, yeah? Okay. I'll be back with you. Thanks, Nicola. Hugely. So in that time in Egypt, they grew from about 70 people to about a million, which is what made the Egyptians so nervous, because they thought, hang on, these guys are becoming too powerful. We've got pyramids to build. We could actually make this work for us. And so they enslaved them. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions about Judges? Yeah. Oh, hold on. Sorry, guys. No.
Why is the converging point not at Jesus, but at Revelation 22? I thought
Yes.
Because of that, the reconciliation is also between Jews and Gentiles together as one person.
Yep. Absolutely. So a great question. So why is Jesus, why is he not the climax of salvation history? Because surely he's actually done everything. And of course, it is true that Jesus has done everything. Sin is completely paid for, the world is, we can actually be reconciled both to God and to each other. There's that division between Jew and Gentile is no longer there. All of a sudden, for that very reason, that's why we're not being commanded to go and kill Canaanites. We're actually called to actually, we're now in a position in salvation history where we actually get to offer the good news of reconciliation to our enemies, not have to drive them out of a nation. The thing is, though, that even here, the work isn't completely done because his work hasn't yet been fully consummated. So, for example, absolutely, I've been forgiven, but I still have a sinful nature and I still sin. That's Romans 6 to 8. And not all of the world has been brought under God's control. Or rather, to put it this way, there's the difference between being under God's control or being under Christ's lordship by right and in fact, if you like. So Jesus, when Jesus rose again and ascended to heaven, he was by right crowned King of the universe. Absolutely. But in fact, in actual fact, is he every single human being's Lord? Do they recognize it? No, they don't. Here, they will. Those who like to recognize his lordship will be living in heaven. Those who don't like recognizing his lordship will be in hell. But everyone will do it. That's Philippians 2:11, isn't it? Every knee shall bow and confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. So absolutely, he's done everything now, but it's still this, we're now living in this kind of time between the ages, if you like.
Until the second coming.
Yeah. That's right. Does that make sense? Yeah. So the way I've sometimes heard it explained, say in World War II, the end of the war, when they actually signed the armistice and actually the war was officially over, was in 1945. But the war was really won on the 6th of June 1944, which was D-Day. It was the D-Day landings. When that happened, that's really when the Allies won the war, because from then on it was kind of mopping up and stuff like that. There's the difference between D-Day and Victory in Europe Day, or the end of the war, VE Day. This is D-Day, this is VE Day, if that makes sense. Okay, other questions? Other questions in particular about Judges, because I love talking about how it fits into the whole storyline of the Bible, but I also... if you want to ask about particular details about, Jephthah or whatever, I don't know if I'll be able to answer them. But any other questions, comments? Rob.
It just seems like there's just no unity between the 12 tribes in Judges. Or, you see them united under a king between Samuel and Solomon, and then they split the two kingdoms up from then on. If they hadn't gone down the path of choosing a king, would it have just kept on sparring and God just kept on sending judges?
Well,
what would be God's ideal solution to that? That they actually did obey him, and then that spiral would have been broken?
I guess, first of all, you're absolutely right. You do see a complete breakdown in relationship between Israelites. So it's really interesting. The very first question you ask in Judges is, Judah says to his brothers, or the other tribes, who shall fight with me against the Canaanites? There's teamwork there. In chapter 17, exactly the same question is asked, but it's who's going to go and beat up Dan with me, i.e. a fellow tribe? It's exactly the same question. That's how far they've come, and hence civil war. I think Judges is trying to get our attention there. What's meant to happen... Well, that's the question. At the end of Judges, we are all meant to look at Judges and go, how did Israel survive? How on earth did this nation actually not completely implode? And the answer is, of course, God's grace. In other words, this is what happens when humans are left to their own devices, when you forget God. I think it is at least in part of the reason. So I think part of the reason is to say, if you're living in the time of the kings and you're wondering, hey, Mum and Dad, why didn't we drive out the Canaanites? This answer's, you know, back before the kings. This is the answer. Oh, that's because great-great-great-great-grandpa and grandma, they didn't drive out the Canaanites and they jumped into bed with their gods. That's why. Let's never do that again. In the period of, in Samuel, yeah.
To be the cause of Samuel in the first place. So there must have been a poor group of
faith. Yeah, there were. Yeah, that's right. And you see, again, in Ruth, you actually see at least one farm that is operating like Israel should. So it's not all doom and gloom, but in the book of Judges, it is largely doom and gloom. But so I think you've very much got an emphasis on God's grace here. Left to their own devices, this is what happens to people. They only ever get rescued when God decides to pick a judge. But then when his judge dies, and you know it's God's leader who dies, then they all fall over.
I think it's important that I think that we realise this is God's sovereign and providence. This is God's plan. It's not like things are running out of control at all. I've got to go fix these men and doing stuff. It's a part of his whole plan. And part of the whole plan is to, it's obviously there for us to learn.
Yeah.
For people then and now to learn. The whole Bible is for us to learn from. And to show us, like you say, without God, man is just totally depraved and, you know, will do his own thing. Because God has to be ultimately in control or we'll never get to that point. So he's fully controlled. I mean, Jesus got crucified and was through the sin of men, but it was God's plan.
Yeah.
Right from the beginning.
Yeah.
So this is all God's plan.
And I think, sorry, to answer your question just as a final thing before we pray, because it's 4 o'clock, like what would God have done if he hadn't introduced the kings? Well, hypotheticals are always hard to answer. I suppose the fact is what God did do is he did say, yeah, that's right, there is no king in Israel and everyone's doing as they see fit. I'm going to introduce a king. And then so he starts the kingship. Now, the kingship itself does bring stability, but it doesn't bring complete stability because having a king is only a part of the answer. You don't just need a king, you need the right king. Israel keeps choosing the wrong kings, hence King Jesus.
So the kings are a good solution to the problem that we see in Judges?
I think certainly the concept of kingship is okay. So, you know, Genesis 49, they're already foreshadowing that there'll be kings. Deuteronomy 14 fully envisages that you'll choose a king. It just says, choose the right king, and in particular, don't just have a king who's like all the other nations' kings. Definitely choose the one that God wants. That's where Israel goes wrong in the books of Samuel with Saul, is that they choose a king just like all the other national kings. They choose Saul, who's, you know, kind of tall and dark and handsome and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So, yes, I think it is, by and large, pro-king, but you need to choose the right king.
Because the book of Samuel doesn't really paint like kings as a good solution, because I think Samuel sort of says you're going to actually be oppressed by this king, and God's sort of offended the fact that they want a king because he is supposed to be their king.
Well, that's right. And so Samuel does have a degree of ambivalence about kings, and that debate is in particular in 1 Samuel 8. The thing that God, I think, is particularly offended by is the type of king they're after. So they say, give us a king like all the nations, and it's that last little clause, I think, that's the key. Because obviously, well, Jesus' last name is King, Jesus Christ, so to speak. Like, he's a king. God can't be anti-kings because he's got Jesus. He's kind of like the king of the whole world. It's the right king. Now, we've gone 3 minutes over, so I'm going to pray. Thank you so much for taking part. I hope you're enthused to get into the book of Judges. And, of course, you'll look at the books of Samuel next week. Next time. Sure. Got any other questions? Just feel free to ask. Why don't I pray? Loving Heavenly Father, we are so grateful to live on this side of Jesus. Living in Israel at that time just sounds like such a nightmare. Father, we thank you that we can live not just under the rule of a king, but the king, King Jesus, whose spirit, whom the Spirit will never leave and who will live forever and so lives always to defend us from our enemies, not Canaanites, but even worse, sin and death. And yet on the cross, our King crushed those enemies decisively and is now unstoppably moving towards a future when all of the world will be united under his kingship. Father, we thank you that we live at this time, and yet still help us to learn from periods much earlier in salvation history, because they still have much to teach us, and in particular, much to teach about us and what we would do if left to our own devices without a ruler like Jesus. Amen. Great.
Thank you. That was great.
Oh, it's fun, isn't it? It's fun. I love it. I'm a bit bummed that I don't get to come back and do it all over again. Anyway, there you go. Thank you.
I've got a Bible study that I do on a Thursday night.
Yes.
And we're doing Judges next.
Oh, yeah.
Tim Keller one, you know.
Oh, Judges for you.